that's the concern, then certainly any, not only police officer, but any witness could be protected under those. So I think that nobody really disagrees that this shouldn't, as a matter of course, be happening, but I'm not sure we have to pass a special statute about it. With regard to confidential informants, again, it just doesn't seem necessary to me to amend the law. That is the law, that you don't have to give over the address or identity of informant unless constitutionally required, and this really doesn't add anything to that. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else wish to be heard on House Bill 2733? We'll move on to new House Bill 2836. Sheriff Perks.
Which bill was that, Mr. Chairman?
2836.
I will not be testifying on that bill either. I'm sorry.
This one,
I think I've testified on all I came to testify on.
Rape statutes apply to acts done by females to males as well as males to females.
I did not mean to sign up on that one, Mr. Chairman.
This is Representative Springer's bill, so and he's left, so maybe we'll just table this thing.
I'll take that as a motion.
We can't table
it.
Okay, we'll hold that one over. That's all the bills we have up for hearing. We need to move into work session. In order to do that, we're going to probably change tape, so we'll take a brief break for anybody to leave the area. Take House Bill 2512, relating to fire protection first. That's a bill I believe that's to us on loan. In any case, there are some clarification questions that we had, I believe. We want to make some inquiries in the Attorney General's office. You're here from the Attorney General's office?
I'm Mike Wyrick with the Attorney General's office.
You have something cogent to say to us on this matter. We're looking for cogency today.
Can you ask him some questions?
Yeah. We should proceed.
Mike, if I could just ask you a couple of questions. At the last meeting, we received a copy of an Attorney General's opinion, OP 5375. And I believe in this opinion, the Attorney General suggested to the Fire Marshal that they obtain from the legislature some guidelines, I guess, in the form of a statute so that the Fire Department could more readily obtain warrants for searches relating to ordinary inspections. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Has there been any other opinions since 1982 in this matter?
No, not that I'm aware of.
Okay. So this opinion is still valid and has not been superseded?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Do you want anything you wanted to say on this?
My name is Gary Underwood. I'm the State Fire Marshal's office. I'm not sure. Maybe I could just go through briefly how an inspection occurred or why we want this kind of a process. I've given you the ORS's 07 and 08 all that pertain to the kind of situations that this would occur. And one of the things I talked to the fire marshal in Klamath Falls this morning about, he has just acquired two administrative warrants pertaining to just regular inspections. And one of those was in the paper not too long ago involving a lawyer's office, and they felt that they had cause to keep them from having a regular fire inspection because of the nature of their papers or whatever was in their office. the idea of the why we have a fire inspection has nothing to do with any other thing than what pertains to fire and life safety, whether the building is safe, where you can exit the building, any hazardous materials that would cause a problem. And so they asked for and did get a administrative warrant. One other situation that occurred was just because the person felt that he wasn't going to let anybody in there without the proper authority, and so this involved getting another administrative warrant. Now, they have a little different situation in that they have a city attorney, and they can go to that attorney, and he can go to the judge and get an administrative warrant without too much problem. However, if you were over in Eastern Oregon somewhere, in some small town that was under the jurisdiction of the State Fire Marshal's Office, it becomes a little more complicated. It's not so easy to run out and find a district attorney or a judge that can do this. What this bill does, it kind of cleans up the process so that it's a little easier to do that when it's necessary. It's not something that we need or require all the time, but there are times when it has to be used.
Chairman, I don't know if I would have any questions. There were some points I came to address as well. As I understand, last hearing there was some questions concerning Section 3, Part 2 of the bill, which deals with probable cause to issue a warrant. State's cause shall be deemed to exist if reasonable legislative or administrative standards for conducting routine periodic inspection are satisfied with respect to the particular building or premises. I've handed out a case which I found that dealt with this specific language. Basically, it came out of workers' comp statutes, and the workers' comp got it from a Supreme Court case. The particular case which involved this language, the court held the language to be constitutional. However, in that case, no one had adopted standards or rules, and so the warrant was held to be invalid. I believe that this language in the bill is fine legally. However, it would require, I guess I wouldn't like to see the situation where it would require the state fire marshal to have every possible circumstance addressed in a rule, or there wouldn't be a warrant issued. I don't know if the committee has given further thought to amendments to the bill, but perhaps it could be amended in some regard where it could say probable cause shall be deemed to exist in circumstances including but not limited to the following, or something to that regards. As I understand, the state fire marshal has not adopted any rules along this line as of yet, although they have obtained warrants on past occasions. The type of circumstances which gave rise to probable cause in the Supreme Court cases were passage of time, the nature and type of the buildings, and the nature of the area to be inspected.
Okay, well, I think the this committee is, this was sent to us from State and Federal Affairs, I think, with the whole question about the question dealing with warrants themselves. So we can't adopt any amendments here. I think unless anybody has any objection, I'd like for a motion to move this to through the full committee back to State and Federal Affairs with a due pass recommendation with the caveat that they would look to the AG's office for possible amendments pertaining to that probable cause question.
I would like to so move, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Phillips recommends that House Bill 2512 be passed back to the full committee with a recommendation to be passed to the State and Federal Affairs Committee with a due pass recommendation with possible amendments to be made to Section 3, Sub 2 to deal with the probable cause issue. That's conceptual, but that's the only thing we can do with it in this committee in any case. Is that understood? Did you have a...
Well, another, I guess I could wait till then. Also, the bill uses the word judges and magistrates interchangeably. I think that should be cleaned up as well.
You noticed that one probably. We could take that as a friendly amendment that would be included too, to clear that up. Any comments on the motion?
I guess we have to take a roll call on that.
Aye.
Phillips. Aye.
Kramer.
Aye.
Burton.
Aye.
Okay, sure. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. House Bill 2179. Which is the Judge Ellis was down. Judge, are you here to make some further comments about that? There was a question here about the difference between judgments and orders. I don't know if we ever got that issue clarified. Could you come up, Judge, and
I'm Jim Ellis. I'm a circuit judge, Multnomah County. We've examined into that further, and to straighten out all the confusion probably would be a major undertaking because there are inconsistent terms used throughout the chapter, and I would suggest that in connection with this bill, that this is a useful bill, and I don't think you ought to delay acting on this to try to straighten up 100 years of confusion over what you call the document that disposes of a criminal case. I've gone through the chapter and analyzed it, and I think there are at least 8 different terms that are used, but I think this bill at least conveys the sense of the legislature as to what you want done if you want to adopt it. The other thing that we left open at the last at the hearing was that Steve Jacobson and I agreed, and I think maybe Steve ought to come up here to present you with an alternative that would squarely present the issue whether the legislature wants to have these financial obligations enforced by contempt or does not, because that was one of the things that we agreed on, that that there is some confusion. And Steve had a proposal from the Metropolitan Public Defender before, and at my suggestion he's expanded it because it dealt with the confusion in this statute, but there's a second statute that I think is arguably authority for using court's contempt powers to enforce payment of financial obligations. And so I think you need to do more than just delete here. You'd have to have an affirmative statement that you don't intend courts to enforce financial obligations by contempt, or the question would still be open to some confusion, and that is because there's a general grant of contempt power to enforce lawful orders. So if it's the legislature's desire that courts not enforce this kind of order by contempt, I think you need to probably affirmatively state that.
Jacobson, you basically want to delete Section 3 of the proposed bill, if I remember correctly.
A good deal of Section 3, but to leave in the new clarification, contained in subsection 6 of 161.685, that made it clear that any kind of money assessment could be collected by any means authorized by law for enforcement of a judgment, and then delete the following section regarding contempt. The policy issue that I was trying to get before the committee had to do with whether or not the contempt power is, my argument is that it's antiquated by statutes that have occurred since then, making this kind of judgment both civilly collectible and a condition of probation. The power is almost never used, and when it is used, it may lead to anomalous results, and I submitted some proposed amendments and some written testimony on that on, I think it was February 27th. At Judge Ellis's suggestion, I've forward to the committee an addition to those previous amendments that would clarify, if the committee decides to delete the contempt power, to add one sentence to what would be left of Section 3 to make it clear that the court would not enforce these with contempt order. Basically, I think what we agreed to do was give the committee choices. and I think there's about three choices that we have. One is to go with the suggestion of deleting the contempt power, and this would be done by adopting the amendments that I proposed. Another one would be to save the contempt power and expand the types of cases that it would be used for, from just restitution and fines to include all money judgments. That would, in addition to restitution and fines, it would include court-appointed attorney fees and any other money assessments on defendants. These potentially can go for any number of years. Nobody really knows how long they go, but they can go far into the future. If you want to do that, you simply adopt the present House Bill 2179. There's a third option at Judge Ellis's suggestion, which is to save the contempt power, expand its use beyond restitution and fines, and also do away with the $25 a day credit that now may be given to a person who is found in contempt of court for nonpayment. And that, I didn't write up those amendments, but I think that would be accomplished by using the present House Bill 2179 and deleting the last sentence of subsection 4 of ORS 161-685. Let me refer to it by page number. On page 2 of the bill, the sentence on line 5 through line 7, if that whole sentence beginning a person committed, if that whole sentence were deleted, it would have the effect that Judge Ellis would be speaking about commitment, the $25 a day credit for commitment. So those are the three choices, and we can respond to the committee and explain what the implications of the choices would be at your pleasure.
Anybody have a choice of the choices, Mr. Phillips?
Well, my choice would be the third choice, save the contempt and do away with what was described as the debtor's prison sort of concept. But I also have a question for either one of the gentlemen. We had discussed including attorney's fees when assessment or cost. I don't think we should overlook that.
Another statute in another chapter expressly defines costs as including the cost of appointed counsel. So it's there. It's just not as clear as it might be, and it's consistent now. The word costs is used throughout that chapter as including attorney's fees. So again, I think probably that's in the letting sleeping dogs lie category. If you add it expressly there, that may detract from the definition in other parts, although my preference is to use the words we mean. I think you might open a can of worms if you clarify that particular one, because there are probably 40 places in that chapter where the used word costs is used to include attorney's fees.
Representative Phillips, in ORS 161-665, which is virtually on the same page as the statute we're amending, there's a long section on costs alone, and they're clearly defined as including court-appointed attorney fees. So we are accomplishing that.
As long as that's clear, okay.
Could I offer two more things? I did do it. I think I'm the one.
Deeper, why not?
I'm the one that has used this. I can't find any other judge who has specifically used this contempt power. I did get a computer workup of the financial aspects, because this is one of the few things you'll consider where you're talking about revenue to the state here, not expense. And of the accounts that I have opened, that is an obligation imposed but not paid in full, at this time, I have a higher percentage paid of these kind of cases where I'm enforcing by contempt than I have percentage paid in probation cases. Now, the dollar amount's a lot larger in the probation cases. That's the bulk of the cases. But about of the accounts I have open, about 10% of the money has been paid. Of the open accounts, about $6,000 has come in. That was the balance as of last month. So if other judges were to use this, if I'm any representative sample, it could be a fair amount of money. I think most of it belonging to victims of crimes, not to the state, but a chunk of it would go to the state of Oregon. Linda Zuckerman, counsel for the Judicial Department, has also furnished something to me that I had overlooked, and that is that this contempt power is specifically included expressly in the ABA standards for criminal justice. That is one of the specific measures that they suggest is appropriate for enforcement of payment of these kind of obligations, and it expressly includes the debtor's prison kind of provision, about which I'm a little sensitive, letting somebody work it off. That, it seems to me that's kind of counterproductive. The reason you're bringing them into court is try to get them to pay a monetary obligation, not to put them in jail and not to permit them to serve 4 days to work off a $100 fine. But that provision is also in the ABA standard. The other thing I was going to point out to the committee that, Ms. Zuckerman called this to my attention, there is another provision, an express authority for enforcing the victim's fund penalty assessment by contempt. That's in 147.265. So this is not a complete anomaly, because that bill was only adopted in the last couple of sessions, I think. But I'd like to return, if I could, for just a moment to say that I do think that the bill itself that's before you is an important bill. Whether you decide to leave contempt in or take it out, the bill itself is an important one to the Judicial Department, because it clarifies a lot of provisions that are somewhat confused now as to how the courts are to handle financial obligations and whether or not restitution is included. And I think it dates... The law needs changing, because historically restitution was not considered of any importance. That's a relatively new concept, but today I think it's a very important one. And so I do think that I would urge the committee to adopt the bill, either with or without the contempt measures, depending on what policy the legislature wants there. I'd be happy to answer any questions. I'm sure Steve would. I don't have anything more to
offer. I'm looking for a sense of preference out of the committee. Anybody ready for a motion?
Why don't I go ahead and make a motion, and we'll just get a feel. I'd like to move House Bill 2179 to the full committee with the amendment on page 2 of the bill, starting at line 5, where we would delete the sentence that reads, a person committed, and throughout the end of that paragraph, ending on line 7.
Okay, Representative Phillips moves to amend House Bill 2179 to delete on page 2 of the bill the sentence beginning on line 5 that starts with a person and ends on line 7. My understanding on that, if I can, in terms of discussion, is that I just want to see here, I think we still need some other amendments besides just that, or is that the only thing that would require that? The question of the plaintiff, I guess that's satisfied with this.
Yeah, what I was hoping to get at, and Representative Springer and I mentioned it, it costs more to keep a person in prison for $25 a day, which is one question, but it's also a basic philosophical question as to whether if a guy owes $100, you want to keep him in jail for 4 or 5 days to, quote, work it off or do his penance. And if this would effectively get out of that, but save the... contempt power, which apparently only one individual is using, but may be a tool for others at a future date, I don't think we should necessarily get rid of it.
Okay. I'm not sure if I should pipe up.
There's a motion on the floor. Do you have a comment?
One observation about what actually may happen is that we're not totally doing away with a person going to jail, at least pending the hearing, or in contempt. And there's still a limit on how much jail time the person could get, and that is limited by a $25 a day concept. So that if a person owed $100 and was found in contempt for refusal to pay, they could be housed in jail for 4 days. Then they'd be released, and they still, under this amendment, they would still owe the $100, and 6 months later you could give them another 4 days in jail for contempt if they're actually refusing to pay the money. And I don't know whether that's a good use of jail resources or not.
Yeah, I understand that. We just happen to disagree, perhaps, on the approach.
Discussion on the motion? Are there any objections to the motion? Besides maybe Judge Ellis. Okay, if there are any objections to the motion to amend House Bill 2179, which would be to eliminate the sentence on beginning of page 2, line 5, and again, line 7, we'll so ordered on that, and then I'll take a separate motion to move the committee as amended. Representative Phillips moves to move House Bill 2179 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. And take the roll on that.
Aye.
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 Thank you. I have a feeling that it's not the last we've seen of that one. Okay, House Bill 2087. Anybody wants to come on up on this one? Come on. This is the disposition of monies bill.
For the record, David Knowles, Director of the Commission on the Judicial Branch. This is a commission proposal, and it was developed by the commission in response to testimony the commission received that the failure of many defendants to pay the full amount assessed, together with the fact that many of them pay on an installment basis, means that the accountants in the judicial department are placed in the position of having to allocate the dollars they receive between programs. It was a function the judicial department felt was better left in the hands of the legislature, and the commission looked at that and agreed that that, together with the fact that it's a very complex system we have in place now, that situation ought to be addressed, and it developed this proposal in response to that. The judicial department was obviously very, very much involved in the development of the proposal, and Linda Zuckerman is here to provide additional information, particularly with respect to those numbers which have been left blank in the proposal.
Are we going to get to fill the numbers today, or are we going to get to avoid that somehow?
Mr. Chair, I'm members of the committee. For the record, my name is Linda Zuckerman, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Judicial Department. This is a day for a proposed fill in the blanks.
You want us to use pencil, is that it?
Perhaps. At the first meeting, basically the presentation given was a general overview of the reasons behind the bill and what it was attempting to accomplish, and then some just a broad overview. We didn't go through the bill section by section, and I don't know how much detail you want, so at any point you can feel free to tell me that you don't want to hear any more about it.
I actually looked at this formula, and after looking at that, I decided I don't want to ask any questions. I just want you to fill in the blanks.
Just fill blanks in. Just to state again, or to kind of reemphasize the one of the problem situations we are facing that motivated the bill, having to do with how complicated the system has become over the past years and potentially would continue to grow more complex. I think you all should have copies of the testimony dated March 16th. And I do describe in that testimony four bills that are in this session that establish new assessments in addition to the volumes of other assessments that we already assess and collect from people in the criminal justice system. House Bill 2629 establishes a $5 assessment on every person convicted of a crime, with those monies to be paid over to county clerks for jail improvement. House Bill 2867 would allow counties to adopt an ordinance to impose an assessment on everyone who is convicted or forfeits bail in a traffic case, which the court would have to pay to the county, so the county could use it for traffic safety or corrections programs. House Bill 3130 creates an assessment to be imposed on every person convicted of a drug offense, with the monies to be paid to BPST to be used to make grants to counties and cities' law enforcement agencies to help in programs using animals to detect illegal controlled substances. And Senate Bill 694 requires the court to impose an additional $40 on every person convicted of DUI, where we would split $30 of that to go to an ignition interlock systems account and $10 to be paid to an ignition interlock systems indigency account. And in addition to that, there are amendments proposed to House Bill 2333, which is the Corrections Department bill, that would require courts to impose a $2 a day fee to offset operating costs for every day that offender is under supervision of the Corrections Division or a field office. So I bring those up just to make the point that it's already a problem. It's continuing to face us every session as people have notions of additional programs that they would like to fund and seek to fund them through additional assessments that would be collected through the criminal justice system. I think the other main problem is that no priorities are established, or very few priorities are established amongst the existing assessments that we do collect. And a major accomplishment of this bill is to establish very clear and consistent priorities for distributing monies that are collected in criminal cases.